in all of time, in all of history, man has never created one single living cell. Yet your body does that millions to billions of times a day. That's where I put my faith. So I try to encourage people. I want them to know that, listen, that there's a doctor 24/7 on the clock, making chemicals, making hormones, detoxing you. So yeah, compared to the smartest person you know or the greatest doctor you think, I'm just saying that level of intelligence is laughable compared to the wisdom that is in you right now, animating you so you can even hear me say this. If I can help you understand the magnificence of the body that God gave you, your fear of disease drops significantly. Your fear of a fever drops significantly because you realize that you're designed to heal. So I'm Dr. Ben Rall. Welcome to Designed to Heal.
Welcome back to the Design to Heal podcast. I am Jeff here with Dr. Ben Rall. And Ben, I'm super excited for today because we have a repeat guest, which tells us we're doing something right, perhaps, for starters. But no, I love this guest because I just remember our conversation last time and he's just so good at what he does. But I don't want to steal the thunder, man. Give him the proper introduction and let's get to it.
Yeah, we're very honored. I think Gerald is our, I think he is our all-time, you know, guest that we've had on here, maybe other than my wife, and she'll always have that reigning title. But having Gerald is really an honor. Gerald Posner, I guess he's an investigative journalist. We've had him on talking about fentanyl. We've had him on. Many of you really got to know him through his book Pharma, which was about the opioid epidemic in part and really the pharmaceutical industry. But Gerald is just a guy. I read everything that he writes. I read because it fascinates me because he goes the other layers deep, not just to complicate and convolute an issue, but to try to figure out how and why is this happening. But he just calls it like he sees it. But I also think he does it just well. I think he does it in a professional way that calls a spade, but also helps you understand what's going on. And so we've been working on having this interview set up, and then he recently released an article. He has a great Substack or a great newsletter, Just the Facts with Gerald Posner. And he had an article that was just published as an op-ed, and it's called The Transing of Sigmund Freud. Okay, obviously a fascinating title. The byline on that, or the line on that, is the American Psychiatric Association's Wall of Silence over its scandalous gender textbook. So today, my friends, we're going to be talking about this gender stuff. We're going to be talking about this transitioning and the drugs, and it touches in a lot of areas. And that's why I think Gerald is so brilliant, because he has the breadth and and the range of these understandings to see how they all fit together. And so, Gerald, thank you for coming back on. Welcome to the show, my friend.
No, look, Jeff, Ben, it's great to be back with you. And you cover a wide range of topics on this. I cover a wide range of topics in terms of my investigations in that. So it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you about this one, which I think is very important and playing out in real time in front of us and is not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, well, let's dive in. Tell us your take. I mean, I know you don't take these topics lightly, and when you put pen to paper, you do your due diligence. What's going on in this part of this in healthcare right now?
So you know, I mean, there are two things, and here's what got me into it. Like 3.5 years ago, my wife Tricia, who's also an author and works with me on all my projects, I had breast cancer, and during the process of getting treatment for that, a nurse said to her at one stage, "By the way, the prognosis for your chest cancer is very good." And Tricia said, "Chest cancer," and she said, "Well, we try to be as inclusive as possible. There are some people who have breast cancer, a very small percentage, like 1%, who are men, and some of them identify as women, and we like to just call it chest cancer so everybody feels that they're covered." And Trish said, "Actually, it sort of makes me feel like I'm left out." and prompted us to look into what I call the degendering of medicine, which is just the NIH, the National Health Service in England, a lot of Europeans, a lot of medical schools that, you know, have replaced breast milk with human milk, have replaced vaginal birth with frontal birth, talk about, you know, pregnant people instead. All right, it's fine. So that was what first sparked my interest. Then when I did the book on the pharmaceutical industry, Big Pharma, that last book that was published in 2020, I'd done a chapter on off-label dispensing, which doctors, as you know, are allowed to do. A drug goes through clinical trials. It's approved for a specific therapeutic purpose. Then you can argue about, you know, whether it's worth it or not, or the side effects. But doctors are sort of given since 1938, viewed as having the power and the ability and the knowledge to go ahead and dispense any drug that's approved by the FDA for any purpose, for any other thing that they think it may be useful for. And sometimes that's led to big multi-billion dollar bonanzas for drug companies, like with a high blood pressure medication that turned out to grow hair as a side effect, so it became Rogaine. Botox, which was given for, you know, involuntary muscle spasms in the throat and turned out to reduce wrinkles and has become a multi-billion dollar a year cosmetic industry. And there was the use of puberty blockers, which are really, you know, these drugs that are given out to, in some cases, they've been given out for precocious puberty, but they really were designed, they're used for medical castration for sex offenders, and they're used in prostate cancer. So there was a group of pioneering endocrinologists in the Netherlands in the late 90s that said, hey, these drugs used for prostate cancer, they tend to pretty much stop the production of your natural puberty hormones. We could give them to kids who have not yet started puberty, who are questioning whether they're born in the right biological sex. It could be another gender. We pause their puberty from developing, and then we talk to them for a year or two. And if they don't think they're right after that time, we start them back on their birth puberty, and all that's happened is they've been delayed a little bit. So there's no harm, no foul, no bad side effects. And doctors are prescribing this. It went to become a billion-dollar business in the last 5 years. Wow. And guess what? Turns out, after I did a little bit of a deep dive, puberty blockers have a whole host of side effects and bad things. I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal called The Truth About Puberty Blockers. And that kicked off a big debate that recently in England has caused puberty blockers to be, you know, stopped from being dispensed to children under 18. So this is just an ongoing process of investigating the question of gender. Kids under 18, do they have the ability to give informed consent? And what's being done here in terms of ideology?
So there's a lot, what you just said there. I mean, there's, you know, I think some, and it happens so fast, Gerald. I mean, I think I'm hearing these things, language that at first, I remember even over the years, Jeff will send me something, you know, that I remember the chest feeding thing. His wife works in that industry. She's a lactation consultant. And so I remember, you know, they get counseled on how you're supposed to say certain words and address certain people. And right away, you've actually, honestly, right away, you think it's a joke. Like, you think this is like a Babylon Bee or this is a bad dream. And then you realize, actually, they're serious about this. And there is big money. And like you said, even this off-label drug use, I mean, I can't wait to see when you start to dive into Ozempic. I'm sure that you're going to have to write another book about that in probably a couple of years as that continues to blow up. But on this gender thing, I think the reason I have two kids, a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old, and of course, just all their friend group, right? So I'm in that season of my life where I'm seeing all these kiddos and stuff, and I'm going, and honestly, Gerald, it just breaks my heart. Now listen, and I'll say this maybe first, and you say it however you want to say it. There are a small subset of people that genuinely struggle with a very real gender dysphoria situation. Mm-hmm. You're correct. I mean, that's not the debate here. Okay, what we're talking about.
That's true.
So I want people to understand. We have compassion for that. Matter of fact, I think as humanity, we have compassion for that. But it goes right back to that story with your wife. But your wife is a woman, and your wife has breasts, and it's okay to call that breast cancer in a woman, right? And that doesn't. And so what we've done is we've created this up is down, 1 + 1 = 3 world that is so confusing. And then medicine came in very quickly. And I think what you're going to talk about are, so I want you to respond to that, Gerald, any way you want. And then I want you to talk about this article and this new book that came out, because I think this is where this runaway train, cat's out of the bag. This is getting into academia, and that's going to be a big problem, because that's going to get into that's where policy gets written. That's where doctors get trained. So take it from there.
Yeah, no, I think that's, you know, what you said is incredibly important, and, you know, goes without saying. Trish and I have a trans friend for many years in New York. I have a family member who has transitioned over, and we think that there has to be absolutely no bias or prejudice against transgender people in the workplace or in society. The bias against them can't be used. And it is, you're right, it is a condition in which the people do legitimately have what's called gender dysphoria. The much tougher part of this is for those 18 and under, which is what I'm focused on, you know, the younger group. And the thing is, they're even in those instances in which a child might have gender dysphoria, true gender dysphoria, and need to be started slowly on the process toward what, a transition, we're talking maybe one in, you know, 0.001% is what some studies say. It's a very small number. And so the clear thing is we're greatly overdiagnosing them, because what's happened is, you know, the diagnosis of gender dysphoria as a term in the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the Bible for psychiatrists, didn't even exist until 2013. So, you know, we use the term all the time, but it wasn't a term that existed until then. And when they first put it into the manual, they said, okay, gender dysphoria requires anywhere from 6 months to 2 years of therapy. And then we are sure that the person's really in tune with what they're going to do is the surgical. Don't put them in the medical pipeline early on. And the Dutch, who were the first ones with puberty blockers, which they've now pulled back on, said, by the way, don't do any social transitioning if you're dealing with kids. Social transitioning means you call people by the pronouns they prefer and you allow the kids to dress in their supposed new gender. Because if you do that, the Dutch said, you're likely to get a false positive, which means you'll never know if it was just a transient phase of adolescence, but the kids will sort of be in the pipeline and ready to go on then to puberty blockers and then to cross-sex hormones in which boys take estrogen and girls take testosterone and then on to surgery. And much of that is irreversible. So once you make those permanent decisions, you're really in trouble.
Well, Gerald, Abigail's book, Cher's book, I think one of her recommendations even with kiddos that have, I just want people to kind of hear this real quick. And I know that you, you know, you've been part of some of her work, but she goes, she said, if you have a child that's kind of socially transitioned, like one of the best things you can do if you're able to do it is actually relocate, like move like to a new area because they don't know you like that. And a lot of times, I guess some of her research, Gerald, I don't know if it's the same, but basically like a lot of those kids, they actually go back to what they were, however you want to say that, but you're right, as you said. So I just want people to understand, you know, what Gerald's talking about here, this idea of a social constraint. I know these are trigger words for certain people, but it's very real, and we need to be able to talk about it because it's the only thing that explains this incredible rise. I'm seeing numbers anywhere from 20%+, Gerald, of you know, certain kids in certain age groups are starting to have these questions. That's not a genetic. That's an environmental type of situation. That's a social construct in part. And I would say mostly, and I don't want to put words in your mouth so you can push back on that or say whatever you want. But
no, there's absolutely no question that in so many different ways, when I say it's a contagion not as a virus, a physical virus that you catch, but sort of a mental contagion of coolness and difference and everything else that TikTok feeds it, social media feeds it, friends feed it. As we know, there used to be dark corners of social media where kids who were anorexic would go on and you know, feed each other, not in food, but in sort of the frenzy and sickness of a body dysmorphia. And that happens in any given area. And it certainly has happened in terms of trans identification and gender identification, because it's often been made to seem, especially to kids, it's a much simpler process. You're different. I know that, for instance, for a member of my family who identified as a different gender when still in high school, in her school, she was considered very, very brave for doing that. All her friends came forward and said, by the way, and she wasn't very popular beforehand, but after she said, I'm a different gender, people said, you're so brave. Mm-hmm. And she sort of had almost this cutting edge take to her. It sort of fed it. And parents, by the way, I've spoken to many parents, don't know what to do, but what they are told often by therapists, and it's one of the things that's become repeated time and time again, it's just not true, which is, if you don't allow your child to do this, if you stand in the way of your child, not only does it border on conversion therapy, like gay conversion therapy, which we know has been banned and is illegal everywhere, but it could put your child at risk of killing themselves. Right. So do you want a living son or a dead daughter? And once parents hear that, of course, if you don't have the stats and don't know that that's not really borne out by the statistics, you can't fight against it. So there is, you know, recently before, you know, Ben and Jeff, before I did this piece on recently on the American Psychiatric Association, what is put out as a new textbook, which we can talk about.
Yeah.
I also done a story a few weeks earlier about a whistleblower who leaked internal files from discussions at the World Professional Transgender Health Organization, WPATH. That is the private organization of doctors, nurses, therapists, members of that. They set the standards of care that are followed by government agencies. Rachel Levine, who's the Assistant Secretary of Health, the first four-star transgender admiral ever as a member of WPATH. The internal files of WPATH show that when the doctors are having their own internal conversations, those members, they admit privately that they know that children under 18 have no capability of forming informed consent about long-term medical procedures with permanent ramifications. They say, you know, they're talking about 10 and 11 years old, and they say, we know that they can't really form that consent, but it's all right if we go ahead and do it because they have a lived experience. They know who they are. Of course, that's preposterous. You know, we were told in COVID to follow the science.
Right.
We were castigated during COVID if we questioned anything about the origin of the lab leak or whether the virus was really as dangerous as we were hearing from Fauci and others. We were considered science deniers. But right. here, science is thrown out the window, and it's sort of this feeding an ideology. You can't say no to a child because they know the ultimate truth. And I will tell you that I think this is a tremendous medical scandal playing out that eventually we're going to look back on in 5 or 10 years and say, you know, what was happening?
I think you're right, Gerald. And, you know, anybody that, and I think you write about it in one of your articles, like, and I know it's the narrative has been massaged in such a way that for many people it's you know, until you see pictures of the surgeries, until you see, you understand physiologically what these drugs do to people, until you hear the horror stories of people that have gone through that and then changed their mind or however, whatever you want to say, regretted it. It's like, it's devastating. Like this isn't anything to take lightly, just like not to go to the opioid, but any more than it was to say, hey, take these opioids. They're not addictive. They'll help you feel better. And then next thing you know, you're an addict and you're breaking into houses and stealing money and you know, stealing from people. Like this is going to, I think, and I pray that it's faster than, I hope we just wake up out of this hypnotized state and we realize what we're doing to people.
Okay.
But yeah, go ahead.
So here's the problem. And, you know, I always sound like, oh my God, you know, sometimes I don't always mean to be the pessimist, but I sort of what I hope is the realist. And the reason I don't think, I know a lot of people who are so-called gender critical reporters, or that they look at this with a tough eye and they're writing about it and they see the problems.
Okay.
The other day in the UK, there was a report put out by a pediatrician, Hilary Cass, had been commissioned by the National Health Service, and it talked about all the problems with that had been embraced on gender identity for young people, and then they had banned puberty blockers in the UK. A lot of people think that the pendulum is swinging back.
Okay.
The reason that I'm a bit more hesitant on accepting that is one of the posts I did up on Substack is called the Transgender Money Pipeline. And when you follow the money, as you do on any situation, you realize there's a lot of money coming into it from some very, very deep pockets. The single biggest contributor is Jennifer Pritzker. She's part of the family of the $37 billion fortune of the former owners of nursing homes and Hyatt hotels. Formerly James, born male at birth, has given a ton of money to this. United Therapeutics CEO Martin Rothblatt, born male but identifies as transhuman. Tim Gill was the first openly gay man on the Forbes 400. There's a Canadian venture capitalist, Mark Bonham, and the creator of the Tides Foundation, and John Stryker, a billionaire heir to the Stryker Foundation. They're giving money at a very fast clip. And what it does, when I say they're giving money, it doesn't come without strings attached. So the strings are let's say Jennifer Pritzker gave millions to the University of Minnesota. They created a program of human sexuality. But the Pritzker Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Lurie's Children's Hospital has the first research center for gender nonconforming children. It got a $20 million gift. University of Chicago's Pritzker School of Medicine was the first in the nation to offer a complete series of gender affirming courses. And in Canada, for University of Victoria, a $20 million grant to establish a sexual diversity studies and gender program. San Francisco University opens up a children's psychiatric unit that specializes in LGBT care. I could go on and on. There's Baylor, there's the Cleveland Clinic. So as these hospitals open up their own studies programs, and as medical residents are starting to learn about gender and gender affirming and gender surgeries, and the surgeons see the money to be made in the surgeries and is paid for completely because it's considered medically necessary, the pharma companies see the benefit of having a client a lifetime of drugs, because once you start on hormones, you're on forever. That it feeds itself. They aren't just going to close shop tomorrow and say, oh, there were a few tough articles from Gerald Posner and, you know, the Wall Street Journal and whatever else, and we'll give up all this money and say it's not here. So we've gone from a few hundred cases from 2007 to 2015. There were literally under 1,000 cases of surgical procedures performed nationwide on children. That means taking the breast off and double mastectomy, creating a sort of a makeshift penis for girls, or a pseudo non-working vagina for boys. 50,000 such surgeries since 2017 to 2024. Now, people say to me, 50,000 is really a small number in a country of 350 million. True, I get it in absolute numbers, but 50,000 compared to under 1,000 is a big jump. And now that we're getting these, what I call funded arms and divisions of major hospitals who have gender studies, some of them focusing on children, that number is going to go up. So anybody that thinks it's, I think these are in some ways not early days. I don't mean to sound that bad, but it's not going to be easy to have it disappear because there is some big money here.
Gerald, I got a question for you. The Johns Hopkins University back in like the 60s, I think, was the first academic institution to offer like what we would call gender affirming surgical procedures, or whatever, sex changes would be the slang term I would refer to.
Right.
But like, what was it, 15 years later, they canceled the program. And I was looking this up because I knew about that story. And so I looked up the guy that was under the, it was the guy that was leading it. It was last name McHugh. I don't even see his first name, but he said this in 2004, commenting on why they shut it down. He said that the reason they shut it down, they've by the way, made history now because they've reopened this, you know, 40 years later or something like that. But he said in 04, he said, "I concluded that Hopkins was fundamentally cooperating with a mental illness. We psychiatrists, I thought, would do better to concentrate on trying to fix their minds and not their genitalia." What's happening? That was 2004.
Well, this takes us right into the book you're talking about, Joe. Yeah, I'd love to hear this.
Yeah. No, it's unbelievable. And, you know, it is interesting because so in 2004, that was said, and they had essentially stopped it because there was a doctor who had been treating children up there in Boston that turned out to be an absolute disaster. And one committed suicide, and then the other died as well, trying to raise twin boys, one is a girl. That whole program stops. And then in 2007, Boston Children's Hospital restarts. It's the first dedicated clinic for transgender minors in America in 2007. And its co-founder was Norman Spack. So, you know, we talk about money, follow the money and see who the ideologues are. He was an endocrinologist who once said to a reporter that he was salivating, that was his quote, at the possibility of treating minor patients with puberty blockers. And the Boston Clinic followed this sort of Dutch protocol of puberty blockers. But guess what? It was the first clinic anywhere not to set a minimum age. So now you didn't have to be 15 or 14 or 10. You could be as young as 8. You could be as young as 7. And so I watched this play out. And from the first Boston Clinic, which is 2007, this what I call transgender minors gender management service at Boston Children's Hospital, we had we now skyrocketed from that to 32. Focusing nationwide just on adolescents. And there are more than 60 dedicated to gender affirming care for minors that are just what we call medical offices or clinics or surgical offices, not full big hospital clinics. But it's a big jump from 2007 and on. Children at Yale's pediatric gender program have been treated I'm not saying this. They have said this. Well, they took it down off their website afterwards as young as three. So how a three-year-old knows, Jazz Jennings, some of your listeners may know, is a transgender sort of reality star that her mother said, I knew when she was two or three years old that she was in the wrong sex. Let me tell you, that's as much about the parents sometimes as that is about the child, because there's no three-year-old that I know. You know, they say, I gave my daughter a doll and she pushed it away, and I gave her a fire truck and she embraced it, so I knew she must be a boy. You know, if somebody tells me that they have their pet owner and they have a dog, and they say to me, I have a vegan dog, that tells me more about the owner than it does about the dog necessarily.
That's a really good point, yeah. Gerald, the question on that too. Like, I was about to ask you about the parents, because these are, you know, as you said, these are no minor surgeries. This is, and I'm not endorsing cosmetic surgery either, but that is run rampant now. I was listening to Brett Cooper on the Daily Wire the other day, and she was, I couldn't understand what the heck she was talking about. She was doing a segment on, she kept saying the phrase BBL, and I'm like, what the heck is BBL? And I had to go look it up, and it's called a Brazilian butt lift. All right. So I don't know. Maybe we can get Ben scheduled for one of those or something like that. But apparently it's very popular, just like breast augmentation and stuff like that. But at least those things, as bad and dangerous, in my opinion, as they are at least somewhat reversible. You know, like these are mutilating surgeries, forever altering how I can't, as a parent, imagine the rationale, like what is being sold to them. You know, what narratives, how is this working?
Well, but didn't Gerald, you kind of touched on this. I'm just thinking, when you're sitting in front of a, you know, we know this through the old studies, right? The Milgram studies and others, right? Put somebody in a white coat in a position of authority that looks at you and says,
yeah,
would you rather have a dead girl or a live boy? Because they're told, if you don't affirm this, this child is going to kill themselves or some version of that.
Wow.
So, and my concern, and I didn't mean to interrupt there, Gerald, but like my concern is, as this becomes normalized quickly, it's gonna be, and I do tend to agree with you, that train has left the station. Reversing this well-funded, you know, situation, now the military is doing this. I saw some reports recently, the military is now paying for these transitions, which really is unfortunate, because this now creates now even though they're adults, it actually then creates they're a lifetime patient, and they can't even serve in the same capacity, because it's like you said, it's still listed as a mental health condition, so they're not even really in a sense fit to serve. So, but to Jeff's question there, can you tell us about, I do want to get into this book that's written, because I think this story, this book you wrote about on your latest Substack, because I think it plays out all of these parts together, right? Like, how is this and where is it going? So you can speak to Jeff's question if you want to, and then we'll jump into
As a quick preface, Gerald, too, and for the listener, I would just say, like, Ben, like as often happens, I'm just in one of those like befuddled, asking curious questions mode here. Like I hope the listener understands, like none of this is scripted. This is us like literally in real time, or at least me in real time, you know, just processing this. And I got a feeling there's going to be a lot of people listening that are in that same state of mind. So Gerald, what you say is going to be extremely helpful.
But it's so great. One of the reasons I like talking to the two of you so much is you said, let's go on the show. You don't tell me what I know we're going to talk about something I've worked on. There's no scripting. There's no, by the way, we're going to talk about this or that. And then we have a conversation. And that's what makes it, you know, so great, I think. And we probably leave listeners saying, I wish he had asked that, or I wish he had answered that. But you're absolutely right. Right before I get to the new textbook, I just did want to say one thing about this process of, when you say, how do parents and the plastic surgeons who specialize in this, and they have websites and everything else that, I don't think that a child and many of the parents who go into the surgeries understand what is at stake, which is a series of disfiguring surgeries in many cases that will leave the child who is transitioning to a so-called new gender as unable to ever have an orgasm, and unable to essentially, they will be infertile as well. So unless they started puberty and were already producing eggs, and in the case of a girl, or sperm is a boy, and the doctor is doing that, save some of it down the road, they will never have children in their new sex. So there's a case in these documents that came out from inside the World Transgender Healthcare Organization, which sets the standards for healthcare for everybody. And they talk about a 14-year-old patient. One member asked advice on a 14-year-old patient, was a boy who identified as a girl and had begun transitioning at the age of four. the child insisted on what's the surgical procedures of vaginoplasty. Sorry for anybody, but there's no other way to describe it. It's a surgery that removes the penis, testicles, and scrotum and repositions tissue to create a non-functioning pseudo-vagina. Requires a lifetime of dilation. Was he too young at 14? Marcy Bowers, who's the president of WPATHS, a California-based pelvic and gynecologic surgeon, herself transgender, said she considered age limits arbitrary, but she would not do it. Why? So you think for a moment, okay, so she's going to say because 14 is too young. He said because the tissue, this is quoting her, the tissue's too immature. Dilation routine too critical. That really means that the boy's too young to have enough penile tissue for the surgery. The surgeons have to harvest intestinal lining to build the fake vagina. And Bowers knows personally the problems with that because when they did that for her client, she did the surgeries on Jazz Jennings. They had to do three corrective surgeries afterwards. These surgeries are almost experimental surgeries and procedures being done on children at an age when they can't appreciate it. And you wonder later what the ramifications are when you realize at 25. There's one doctor who says in here, and by the way, they all say, oh, I don't worry about not having children. It won't be an issue for me. And then when they're 25 and suddenly think that they want one, then it becomes an issue. And you know, you mentioned before, Ben, what about this new story about what's happening with the textbook that the American Psychiatric Association has put out? So we have all of this, for lack of a better word, let's call it a social contagion taking place in which kids online are getting the idea that they might be another gender. They're talking to a school counselor. They're talking to a therapist. They're talking to somebody at school who says, yes, okay. The current standard is that anybody you talk to in a professional status should affirm what the child says. You shouldn't counter or be negative about it. So the idea is you affirm and you say yes. So we are saying as a group of, let's say, writers and journalists and others, let's slow the process up. Instead of rushing children into the medical pipeline where they start to get hormones and then surgeries and you can't reverse them, let's emphasize therapy. So just at the moment when we say that, the American Psychiatric Association comes out with a book that it puts out last December, which essentially is an ideological handbook that pushes children as fast as possible from the therapist chair into the medical process in the pipeline. That's just the opposite of what anyone would think. It's filled with incorrect information. It says things such as puberty blockers are not dangerous. The editor of it is a young self-described activist, a first year residential resident in psychiatry. And the 50 of the 56 contributors to the book are themselves, as they call it, non-binary or trans. The editor of the book, the young editor in his early 20s, describes themselves as a quote, non-binary, that I'm quoting from their own, about the writer routine. I'm a, quote, non-binary, trans, queer, neurodivergent, chronically ill, Jewish person, end quote. There's a lot packed in there. But my question is, 7,000 doctors, clinicians, people, nurses, and others in Europe and the U.S. signed a petition made by four doctors and presented as an open letter to the American Psychiatric Association and said, please withdraw this book. It's out of date before it was printed, and it has all types of incorrect information in it, and they have been ignored. So one of them approached me and said, maybe you can get an answer. I wrote a story about this. It was published in the New York Post. The American Psychiatric Association ignored me as well. They won't give an answer. They won't say anything. They won't withdraw the book. They have their head in the sand, and one person who's familiar, who is themselves a psychiatrist, familiar with the leadership, said to me, it's an intimate group. They believe that if they stay quiet, it will go away. And I must tell you that the book is just sort of jaw-dropping in the sense that it has one claim after another that leaves you scratching your head. It would be bad enough if it was published by any first-year resident at a psychiatry school, but that it is the official textbook on gender-affirming care by the American Psychiatric Association, their first one ever, is really unbelievably upsetting.
Gerald, what, and I know your work as an investigative, you know, journalist and the work you've done, obviously I know that it's probably bad practice to conjecture, or you know, you try to stay away from just your opinion on this, but I think we're all scratching our heads. And I know there was some stuff even other where you're seeing in medical schools where they're making them, they're changing their oath, they're changing the way that we, you know, that they're asked to engage with patients on a lot of things, even a little bit what you touched on with your wife there. I'm not holding this as gospel to you to say that, but like what you say, follow the money. You're so good at digging behind this. Is what is the say the agenda? These are all those words, but like why? Because it and somebody wrote, I think it was in your article, Gerald. They said some of those authors that wrote that document, that open letter, said like we're trying to like this is going to be really damaging to the profession. Like I'm a chiropractor by profession, so like if there was something going on in my profession where all of a sudden we took a really weird non-scientific stance on certain things, like I'd be concerned as a chiropractor. I'd say this is reflecting bad on me. You know what I mean? So they were saying like this isn't going to age well, guys. You know what are we doing here? There's other ways to San Francisco to use that metaphor, but like why is this? Do you have some thoughts on it? I know it's your personal opinion, but gosh darn it, it seems like weird. They would push it this hard, ignore all that pushback, have this person do this. What's going on?
Well, I think that the inmates have taken over the asylum, and what I mean by that is these are not the people, for instance, writing the textbook for the American Psychiatric Association are not looking at this as a money making opportunity. They aren't charlatans who think, you know what, we don't really believe this, but let's say it anyway. We'll make $1 million and have a successful show. That's not their gig. They are real ideologues. They believe in their heart and soul that gender is the only way to do away with this fake construct of two sexes. And I'll give you a quote. The editor of the book on the American Psychiatric Association says that pretty much tell you from the very, very start, that all scientific neutrality is a fallacy. What matters is prioritizing lived experience. And this sort of is the key point. Binary gender norms, men and women, are fake news from European colonialism and white supremacy. So now you have this mixed up into the whole pot of DEI, race studies. Now that's not somebody posting that on their Twitter account and you say, okay, delete that. Now we're getting it into a book that's the textbook that will be used by first year medical residents, both psychiatric and non-psychiatric, by people who practice in the area, by therapists, by counselors, by schools and others, as the guidebook. And if that's your philosophy, if that's what you think, that's what you've sort of been taught, and that's what you believe in and there are many more examples of this, they really do think that there's no such thing as male and female. Forget chromosomes, throw those aside. Don't follow the science. Don't be a biologist. Don't get stuck in that quagmire. And part of the if you want to know where the cutting edge is, and that's a bad word to use when it comes to surgeries like this, there for 2 years now, the WPATH, the World Professional Transgender Group that I wrote about in those internal files, they've embraced something called nullification surgery. So you think, okay, what? So we talked before about if you're a girl and they're going to try to make you what would be look like a boy, and you're a boy, they're going to try to make you look more like a girl. Nullification surgeries are designed for people who identify as non-binary. And the proponents of that have said, and they've won the day in the standards of care for gender care, believe it or not, in surgery in the U.S., they say we shouldn't force young people who are gender questioning to have to decide on a binary choice. Do I want to be the opposite sex or not? Maybe they don't want to be either sex, and therefore nullification surgeries can in some cases have both sets of genitals. So if you have a penis, you now have a non-functioning vagina that's sort of added to it, and the penis is sort of surgically moved to the side. It's a gruesome stomach churning surgery, and vice versa for girls. Or all the sex organs are removed, the external sex organs, and the person looks like, and these are on the internet, they're on some of the sites that these doctors show, looks like a department store mannequin. If you saw a department store mannequin with no clothing on, it's a neutered figure. Uh-huh. And that means, you know, the breasts have been taken off girls, they're just scar marks. Sometimes they argue about where the scar marks should be. there's no visible sexual organ, and they're nullified. And that's a third choice now. Now, I'll tell you something. You're doing this as a physician who has taken an oath to do no harm, and they are making big money on these surgeries because they're passing them all off. They talk about this in WPATH. They're passing them all off as medically necessary so they get them covered by insurance. They understand how to run the system so they get paid out on insurance. They're not worried about that.
Gerald,
there's a problem.
That made my stomach churn. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry to have such a. I know. I'm sorry to upset.
It is upsetting. It's why we do the show. It's why we have to talk about. It's why I was grateful to have you on. I know you're. Not only did I know I ask you kind of your personal thoughts on why this is happening, but I am thinking about when you wrote the opioid book, Pharma, which, by the way, I love Gerald's work, and he's written a lot of books, and his wife has written books as well, and they're always this thoughtful. Do read those books, and I know you've worked on other projects, and you've interviewed a lot, and you even some of your material has been made into different documentaries and things like that, but. You had some thoughts on in that book about where could we go? How could we help this problem, right? What are some potential solutions out there? Not that that you're the keeper and you have to figure all this stuff out, but where do you have some hope for us? Do you have any thoughts or ideas on how you could see this being rectified? Because you said, I agree, the chain has left the station. At least right now, there's too much money behind this. It's not going to slow down right now. Maybe it's peaked, maybe not. We don't know. We'll find out, but... Maybe I'll just say to the parents that are listening to this, right? And like me, I have a child in that age group right now, or children in that age group. And we're all asking ourselves, kind of scratching our heads a little bit, right? Saying, hey, what do I do? I want to protect my child from, of course, having that. Or you're hearing a lot of these stories about at schools, they don't even have to tell the parents. And you're seeing some of these horror cases where they're taking kids away from the parents because the parents didn't affirm it. And they're removing them from the home, and they're, these kids are having surgeries and put on blockers. Like if it wasn't happening, I think that it was a lie, but I mean, I read these stories. I see these interviews. Yeah. Where can we, any thoughts, any hope?
Yeah. I mean, no, you're right. And there are some states that have really pushed the boundaries, by the way, in terms of that. I mean, Oregon, a perfect example. And in Oregon, a law passed a year ago allows a guardian, to sign off on both as a double mastectomy for a girl, the start of hormone blockers or hormones themselves needs a guardian, but it doesn't have to be the parent. And a therapist or a teacher at the school can act as the guardian and does not have to inform the parent. Now, the amazing part of that is in Oregon. I love that state. I visited. I do like it. To use a sunbed, you have to have a doctor's written note and your parents' permission, and not until you're 18. So I love that. And you can't until you're 18 use a sunbed because it could cause cancer and have long-term deleterious effects. But if you want to have your breast taken off at 15 is the earliest age, you can do it if your school counselor wants to sign the paper for you. So that's just another end.
And the school counselor who's being told by the standard operating to affirm all of that happens. So it doesn't even have a choice. Right.
I have a piece up on my Substack, an article called Who Put the Kids in Charge? Mm-hmm. And that's really the question, because the kids are in charge. And, we don't let them get a license till they're 16. We don't let them do a rental car until they're 25. We don't let them make decisions on sterilization until they're 21. But we allow them to, cut their breast off at 13 in some states. And so anyway, what can be done? I think we need, I am not a big believer in government commissions, because I normally think government commissions are a way of throwing the problem under the back, and nobody ever pays attention to it again. But what happened in England recently in the National Health Service, now they have a different health system. I get it's government run, so it's easier for them to do. But this Hillary Cass report really put the flashing warning yellow signs on under 18 adolescent and children gender care. And as a result, puberty blockers now banned. They're relooking at the surgical procedures, a whole bunch of things. We can't do it state by state here, because if we do it state by state, it's typical of what we do in the United States. It becomes a political issue. So red states and Republicans say nothing at all for anyone under 18. So even in the one in 100,000 kid, like you said, Ben, who might actually have gender dysphoria, right, they're not going to get anything. No one's going to get anything. And then the other states like Oregon is say, the candy machine is over here. Come and get your puberty blockers. Mm-hmm. So somewhere in between, there has to be a happy medium. And the happy medium is to maybe have a federal commission that is looking at passing a law where instead of making it a Republican or Democratic issue, we make it a children's issue, a healthcare issue for children. And we actually get recommendations in a short amount of time from doctors who are independent, who aren't either ideologues or aren't captured by one of the big pharma companies putting out Lupron, and they can help reach a consensus that says this is the national policy and federal policy. You're not going to be able to get puberty blockers before 18 or have surgery unless you meet these diagnostic criteria. Is that going to happen very easily? No. It'll be fought for, and they'll try to stack the odds on who it is. But if we don't do it at a federal level, we're just going to have state madness for the next, 10 years. One state will be absolutely terrible, and one state will be a little bit better. And like you said earlier, you don't want to be in a position as parents, although Abigail Schreier and her great books talk about this, where you have to move. You do anything for your children. I get that. But moving should not have to be required to save your child from what I call, bad science and bad medicine.
Yeah. Well, Gerald, I mean, you've given us, you've given us a lot to think about today. You've given us a lot to think about, a lot to, images in our mind. You've given us a lot and it's not a laughing matter. But we need to know where we're at because I'm with you. It's this tension between I'm not a big fan. Of course, I'm a medical freedom kind of guy. I believe in much of that. So I don't like big government. I don't like mandates. But there is this, something has happened where all of a sudden to use your term, prisoners running the prison. I don't know. It just happened so fast. The coddling, you're hearing a lot about those terms, right? The coddling of the American mind, some of those books that have come out recently, right? Where really it's just cater to the kids. I saw an article recently, maybe it was from you, some school district somewhere that's, they call these kids Furbies, right? They can go into a litter box in the bathroom, right?
I saw that.
It's the same lostness in that we're just acquiescing and affirming madness, and then when there becomes an industry behind it, it's really hard to stop that train. And so I do want people to stay informed. They need to be they need to follow your work. They need to follow that. And so I'm going to give you last word, and then will you let them know your best properties to follow, or maybe a resource that you think that are good to follow?
Yeah, and I'm also sort of a medical liberty person. I don't like the idea. I hated the idea of what COVID was doing and how people came in and how the government used it as a cudgel to try to force behavior to take place in that. And so I'm always worried as well. I mean, here I am now saying maybe we should have a federal commission and set some standards to that. And oh my God, it's just the opposite. But I don't. Over 18, you can do what you want.
Right.
If you want, I don't like the fact taxpayers are paying for it. But if that's what the government decides, fine. Then taxpayers will pay for it. There's nothing we can do about it. And you can make your own bad decisions as an adult. If it's not affecting somebody else, go ahead and do it. I may think you should wait to 25. That's never going to happen. So over 18, fine. What I'm focusing on is just that question of the kids. And I will tell you another fix, a sidelight before I give you the resources, is changing the ridiculous law that allows doctors to prescribe FDA-approved medications for anything that they think they want to prescribe it for. When that law was passed in 1938, there were a couple dozen drugs. Now there are 4,000 different variations of drugs. Doctors don't even know, what they are that they're often using or how they're prescribing it. You have Lupron, which is now a multi-billion-dollar drug that is put out, in which the company does not have to go back to the FDA to get approval to have this for gender dysphoria, but it's being dispensed in large numbers for it. That should not be allowed.
Gerald, I know we've got to run, but I really do want people to hear this one more time, because I don't think they believe that. I don't think that we really understand. It is a very weird thing that we do. Think about all this, and now listen, I got my concerns with the FDA. Even on their best day, I think they do a crappy job. So let's just get that clear on that. But let's just say that they did do some studies and they did deem it to be somewhat safe for the XYZ condition that it's approved for. And so you hear all those stories about how hard it is to get a drug approved and all the process, and some of that being true. But the craziness that once that drug is approved for a certain condition, I mean, this was in sense, Gerald, what happened with opioids to some degree, right? I mean, it was supposed to be, from my memory, I mean, inpatient cancer, you know, end of life kind of situations. And then all of a sudden, right, it's after that. I mean, there was many things that happened, but all of a sudden, next thing you know, it's, you know, Bob, you know, I had a family member who got it given opioids for, you know, their knee surgery, just as like a obviously give it. It doesn't make any sense. So people do need to understand, because they go, how does this happen? Well, if to your point, Gerald, if these drugs had to go through the actual, you know, re-licensing or go back to get approved for these, I think most of them wouldn't, because of all the things that we're talking about today. So the fact that they call it, you know, off-label prescribing, and all of a sudden these deities known as doctors apparently are smarter than anything else. And once it made through the FDA, if they think on this windy day they want to give it for this drug, and make no mistake, the pharmaceutical companies know that's where the billions are at. And so they are more than happy to oblige in promoting off-label drug uses. I mean, that's why many of these people got in trouble. Many of these, you know, Prozac and onwards. So, you know, I don't know if you have a final word on that, but this should not be, that's a fix that is doable. You're right.
That's right. And, you know, I think even your listeners who are informed about the abuses of the pharmaceutical industry, that may be surprised to know that off-label dispensing is responsible for about half of all prescriptions in the U.S. That's really astonishing. It completely circumvents the FDA's authority to examine drug safety and efficacy, especially with the patients or children. So, you know, half of all the drugs, the multis, billions of dollars of profits coming in are off-label. That to me is a terrible situation.
Yeah.
People can find me if they want more information on my Substack. It's just the facts with Gerald Posner. Also on Twitter, Gerald at Gerald Posner. And also I have a website about some of my work on books, and try to keep that up to date as well. And that's just Posner.com, P-O-S-N-E-R.com.
Well, my friend, I'm sure that we'll have to chat again. You know, I didn't think that this would be what we'd be talking about. I remember talking to you years ago and asking you about other projects you were doing, and now you've had to jump into this one. I thank you for just being willing to step into these conversations and kind of just take you where the science or the wherever it takes you. You know, you're willing to jump into these issues and ask questions that many aren't willing to ask. And I know it's hard to get, you know, sometimes get platforms and get people. I remember when you wrote pharma and you were having all these people that normally would talk to you wouldn't talk to you anymore. I remember you telling us that story.
Yeah, no. You're right. And, you know, and I get on fire on different topics. So I'm on fire on issues of anti-Semitism and what's happening on college campus. I'm on fire on a number of different things. But what happens is you do your best work, I think, as a journalist when you really are motivated to write about it. It's not because you expect a check at the end of the day from some magazine that's going to publish your piece and you're just looking at doing that, but you really and people sometimes say to me, who follow my work over time, because I've done, you know, work on 9/11, on terrorism, political assassinations, they say, oh, gender, this thing on gender and kids, doesn't it seems like a distraction? It's such a small number of things, it's so small in the side, like it seems like you should be doing work instead on saving democracy or you know, or what's happening and this and that. And there's no answer for that. I understand that some people just view it as a sideshow because they either don't have children or their children are fully grown or it's not an issue that relates to them in any way. But it has ramifications for all of us about the way medicine plays out, how the rules are broken constantly by ideologues, and how the medical societies are supposed to serve us often don't do it at all.
Well said. Well, continue to follow my friend's work. He's always on the cutting edge and he always finds things, details and connects dots that many aren't aware of. He really is one of the guys that cracked the code on helping us understand the Sackler family and what happened. And really is many of much of his work has really changed the game on even how things are litigated and things like that. So an honor to have you on the show, Gerald, and I'm sure we'll have to have you back in the future.
You.
Probably talk about some other crazy topic, but
exactly.
Have a beautiful day. My best to you and your wife. We'll take
care. Thank you. All right, thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Ben. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Designed to Heal. Always remember that the greatest doctor lives inside of you, and God gave you what you need to be healthy and well. Connect with Dr. Ben at drbenrawl.com or achievewellness.clinic. And please share this podcast with someone who needs to hear it, and follow us on Instagram at Designed to Heal Podcast.